Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster. And with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great. I am doing awesome. Just before the show, you were telling me how busy of a day you've had.
Let me just say happy Tuesday to everyone. Thanks for joining us on not our typical night. I'm on the road this week, and it was not going to work out to do the show on Wednesday. So, Stephen, being the ultimately flexible guy you always are, we're doing the show tonight. And for anyone who's everyone who's joined us live, thanks for being with us on a Tuesday. I'm actually attending the Teradata Partners Conference in Anaheim, California this week, and have been having a fantastic time. And I got two kind of observations related to this program about what I've been seeing and hearing. This is a big, for those who aren't familiar, Teradata is a big technology company. They do data warehousing solutions. They were originally a big data warehouse appliance. You would buy hardware and software, you know, it's like you'd buy the whole machine back when they were first introduced 30 years ago. And slowly they've sort of morphed into this software company. In fact, they've just released a new version of their software on the Amazon cloud. So having started out as kind of a proprietary hardware solution, they're now this software solution that you don't even have to own the hardware anymore. It's a big interesting kind of transformation that this company has been through. But what I'm hearing people talk about here at the conference really interests me because I got to say, Stephen, the real world is catching up with the world transformed, is all I can tell you. You know, the discussion of the Internet of Things, which is a topic we've talked about any number of times before, is very much on everyone's mind. And the implications of sensor technology and, you know, using big data in real time to solve complex problems, very much on everyone's mind. Do you know, do you ever watch Shark Tank?
Yeah, it's a good show.
Oh, yeah, okay. So you know Robert Herjavec. He was a keynote speaker on yesterday, and he spent a good deal of time talking about, you know, kind of the arc that technology's on, and spent a lot of time talking about self-driving cars. Well, you're used to hearing that kind of thing in the keynotes, but what I've observed is out in the breakout sessions or people just sitting around at lunch, everyone's talking about this now. It's like this is the, you know, it's an idea that has arrived. The technology community is embracing it. They're dealing with it. I mean, I heard people talking about it today at lunch, and it was the same conversation I've heard so many times before about, well, I like to drive. I don't know why I have to give up driving. And I didn't get to give them the argument. I'm always standing by with the Stephen Gordon argument about self-driving cars, but it just, somebody changed the subject before I was able to. I hope to catch him tomorrow. I'm going to say, hey, you remember what you were saying? I got to tell you why it's okay that we have self-driving cars. But here's the reasons you're wrong. Exactly. Here's what you're missing. Okay? You know, tens of thousands of people. All right. We're talking about human lives here. So that's one observation. The other one is podcasting as a full-time job is not something I'm prepared to do. I've learned now that I'm really good for about an hour a week. I got to participate in five podcasts, five interviews. They weren't as long as this show. They were mostly 5 to 10 minutes each, but five little interviews that I conducted. And then, because the event is being live streamed on the web for people who aren't able to come here, between sessions, they have this live talk show where people who are either employees of Teradata, people who work for customers, or people like myself, considered to be an industry influencer, just come on and talk for a few minutes about things that are interesting. So I conducted five interviews today. I got interviewed once, and now here I am in my off hours doing a podcast. It's just, there's no real distinction, I guess, between work and leisure anymore. It's all turned into one big.
It all flows into one thing. Well, hey, you've written extensively about that, Phil. So I mean, how there shouldn't really be a distinction. You know, you follow your passion either way, don't you? So
exactly. Just who would have guessed it would be so exhausting? I guess that's the part I found a little bit surprising about the whole thing. But anyway, it's a great time. I love being here, and I always love coming to Southern California, and it's really interesting to get up close into the technology industry and see people bringing about things we talk about. You know, it's like almost this little feeling of kind of the future happening here. I spoke to
the future is a little bit more distributed there in Southern California than anywhere else. Maybe Japan,
actually up in the Silicon Valley, it's really they really got their share of it up there, I think. A lot of those people are here, and interestingly, Teradata, they've got a big presence down in San Diego. So there's just this whole kind of convocation of interest in these kinds of topics all through California. But one of the people I know in Colorado, actually, Dr. Richard Hackathorn, I spoke with him today, and he's a really interesting guy in the area of, I mean, really interesting guy anyway, but quite an expert in the area of big data, quite an expert in the area of data warehousing and analytics. And he and I were talking, and he starts talking about this immersive analytics project that he's working on. I'm actually conducting this interview with him, and I said, "And tell me what that is." He said, "Well, that's creating a virtual space for analytics." And I let the phrase sink in for a minute, and I said, "So, Richard, you're saying virtual as in virtual reality?" And he said, "Yes, exactly. That's what we're talking about. So you know, you can deal with just numbers, or the next layer up is the numbers get turned into visualizations. You know, interesting graphs and charts and things that give you this layer of abstraction to make it more real." Well, they're taking it to the next level where you can walk around inside the data. And they're talking about, you know, aural, you know, displays you can hear, tactile displays of data that you can that you can touch. So, we talk a lot about
that
kind
is
of
amazing.
The datafication of the world. And here, this is kind of the worldification of the data. You know, so somehow things are going to meet in the middle. But, you know, he's putting together programs where they use Oculus Rift so that people can interact with data in ways that they haven't before. I only got to talk to him for a few minutes, but he and I have agreed to talk further, and I think he's going to come on the show, and we'll do a full hour on this subject at some point.
I want to visualize this just for a second. Imagine one of your young children, Phil, in college in a few years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Dad, could you walk around in my research paper and see what you think before I turn it in?
Yeah.
Wow.
When you talk about getting your hands on it, they're going to literally mean getting your hands on it. You know, go take a swim in my information. It's like I hear that and I can almost understand what it means, but not quite. So I'm looking forward to seeing a greater demonstration of that, but
it's probably something unless you experience it, you probably won't be able to it's like put on the Oculus Rift and actually experience it, and then you'll begin to understand. Well, a lot of times you build the technology and then you figure out how to utilize it. You know,
right.
So you know, even he, as smart and as into that stuff as he is, he might not he might be seeing part of what's the future is in that area, but not have it all yet, because you know the killer app has yet to be envisioned yet, probably for that.
Well, if it has, I haven't heard it yet. That's for sure. And in fact, I was having a hard time even getting to in my head a practical application, but which is not to say there's not one, because major
it's there. It just has to be discovered.
We got to figure out what it is. But if we take some more time to talk with him, I bet we'll get a clearer idea. And who knows, Stephen, you and I might come up with that killer app, which would be
that'd be pretty cool. We could
not all that unusual. We'll see a little bit later in the show. Sometimes we nail the future pretty tight, as we'll come to here in just a few minutes. Well, let's jump into. I'm sorry, Stephen. How are things going with you? Any big news?
It's doing real good. You know, like you've had a busy day as well. Working all day in multiple locations, which is possible because of the datification of my profession.
Right.
You know, multiple offices. It doesn't matter where I'm at. I've got all my files with me, and I can handle cases from anybody. So I go where the people are. And then work on my files regardless of where the physical paper is. Paper doesn't even matter anymore. So then of course at the end of the day, spent some time with one of my middle kids, getting him off to the local college and getting him back home again after an evening class. So yeah, busy day. So that's all right. That's the way I like it. I don't want to be sitting around with nothing to do. So
there you go. Well, the future is not evenly distributed, but you and I have our share of it. That's for sure.
We've taken
a good deal of it on because we see it, and it's like, okay, I'll have some of that. But you know what we're talking about tonight is I thought this would be fun, so I've written this up in a sort of tongue in cheek manner, talking about all the amazing things that maybe could someday happen in the future. And they all sound like futuristic predictions, but of course, every one of these is something that's actually happening right now. These are things that are occurring. One of them is just conceptual, but even that the concept is something that we're dealing with is actually pretty darn interesting. So I want to start with this first already true prediction. For example, we might do experiments that put us in touch with parallel universes. Okay, so that's our first amazing thing that might happen someday in the future. And of course, we've got this story. I believe I linked it from a less reputable source, theexpress.co.uk. And as I look at them, they've got some really weird news stories. So I double checked, and the Daily Mail is significantly more reliable than the Express. And here's the headline: there, could scientists soon discover a parallel universe? New data from the extra-powerful Large Hadron Collider is being analyzed. The atom smasher at CERN, Geneva, is turned up to its highest level. This means it can detect miniature black holes, a sign of a multiverse. Ongoing experiment at the LHC could shed new light on the universe. So it seems that in some ways we've heard about this before. Certainly we've heard about the possibility of detecting miniature black holes before, but I've not seen it in this context of we're going to detect a parallel universe. But apparently, according to the physicists who are working at CERN, this is exactly what they may be on the verge of doing. Now, I put a tongue-in-cheek message out to my sister on Facebook earlier today, because she and I have been talking about the Berenstain Bears and some of those other fun parallel universes that we've been talking about over the past few weeks. And I said, well, maybe they'll find that world, right? Maybe they'll put us in touch with the world where Nelson Mandela died in prison, or one of those things. But apparently that's not what this means. If you read a little bit deeper, when they talk about parallel universes, they're actually talking about very small universes folded over in other dimensions. So
It's right. It's those little mini pocket string theory universes that you hear about. Still very interesting because they are still separate universes from ours, but not the, you know, the spot.
Well, they're creating conditions, Phil, that are akin to what happened at the time of the Big Bang.
Right.
You know, and so what they are causing is, you know, miniature black holes, and sometimes perhaps and we'll see, I guess, miniature universes. And, you know, obviously the one of the big questions that people could have is, you know, how dangerous is this? Well, they've been doing the these little miniature black holes for a little while, and so far so good. You know, maybe it's one of those things, Phil, that will always be in the reality where everything's working out okay.
Right.
Because in the parallel universes where we destroy the world is destroyed, you know, we're not around to bemoan the fact that it didn't work out. So maybe that's the deal. But
it could be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of forward-reaching retroactive thing where you always stay in a universe. What's that called? There's actually a, what is it, quantum suicide? Is that what that's called?
Quantum immortality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
As a species, as a universe, we're experiencing quantum immortality.
That's
a very optimistic thought, I think. I like that.
Yeah, it's that's an encouraging thought. Okay.
Maybe we were meant to believe it's true, right? Absolutely no evidence to believe it's true, but it's encouraging. So
no. We'll go with that.
We'll stick with it. I'll tell you, I think what we're learning from the work they're doing at CERN is probably worth whatever negligible risk is involved in creating a mini black hole. I know that these discussions always lead down the somebody's going to set off a chain reaction and the universe won't exist anymore. But I really think that the level of impact that what they're doing, if something like that was going to bring it into the universe, surely bizarre things are happening elsewhere in the universe that might be bringing about some of those same kind of effects. Granted, we don't know that anyone else has a Large Hadron Collider, and they are creating highly rarefied, highly specialized events using it. But it's kind of hard for me to imagine that virtual particles aren't flipping on and off, that there aren't black holes elsewhere causing all kinds of interesting little effects. You know what I'm saying? It's like it really seems unlikely that anything they do is going to take the whole universe down. It might blow us up, right? But even that's
it would be a localized problem, I would think, to this solar system probably. But you know what is encouraging to me, Phil, is that the idea that we may have spotted a Dyson swarm, and if that civilization could make it to that level of if it is what we hope that it is, and if a civilization could make it to that level of development, maybe we have a hope of doing so as well. So,
absolutely.
Anyway, keep our fingers crossed that, they do all goes well. And what they discover, like you say, if there's some small amount of risk, then the payoff, it could be huge. We're talking, we're learning the basic building blocks of this universe, and it could allow us to do things that we've only dreamed about in our science fiction. And so, who knows, warp drive, or whatever. And so let's,
it. The other thing we have to acknowledge about this is, even if it's not the same kind of parallel universe as the entertaining kinds that we like to talk about, this would eliminate that kind of very limiting definition of what a separate universe means, which I've heard it said. I think Michael Anisimov once said it on this show, which is that by definition, two universes can never have any contact between each other. If there's any contact between them, then there's no, then it's not appropriate to call them two different universes. Well,
this would actually be an instance where we would be getting information back and forth, or from, I should say, what is scientifically a separate universe. And if it can happen under these circumstances, then, you know, potentially, you know, we might have one day, Stephen, might be able to get the guys who do the world transformed on the world where the Berenstain Bears are the Berenstain Bears and, you know, have each other as guests or something like that.
That's right. Imagine, imagine filling a hard drive with you know, all kinds of media from a local close but not quite us parallel universe. You know, all the interesting alternate takes on different, you know, I don't know, movies, you know, pop music, whatever. You know, so it would be interesting.
Really fun science fiction story. I remember reading about that in the 70s. It was in Asimov's Science Fiction magazine, and somebody had set up a business doing exactly that. They had established trade with the parallel universe, and they were selling things like it wasn't DVDs. That wasn't the technology at the time. It was probably VHS, but it was in their universe. Casablanca had been like just a stinker. You know, it had starred like Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman. You know, and so. In this universe, it's like a collector's item, right? Because then he went on to be president and those kinds of things. They're really interested in our version that had Humphrey Bogart in it. And it would be an interesting mutual market between the two. Very unlikely, but fun to think about. Okay, we've got a number of other amazing things, so we have to keep moving here in the interest of keeping it amazing. So here's another thing that might happen. We might just accidentally stumble upon a cure for cancer. And once again, that seems to be something that we're very close to being able to examine whether that's occurred. I've actually got this page open in my browser, and it looks something out here. I've finally got it open. The headline, it was in the Independent. The headline is "Cure for Cancer Might Accidentally Have Been Found, and It Could Be Malaria." So, you know, it's like, well, in that case,
amazing.
I guess the yeah, well. You know, when you just hear malaria, you go, well, I guess that cure is better than the disease, but you don't really want to have either one of those two things. But when you read a little bit deeper, just some astounding research that's gone on here. The scientists looking into the problem of women who are pregnant getting malaria. It's a very difficult problem to deal with because the malaria goes right to the placenta, so it puts the baby in danger, it puts the mother in danger, and, you know, it's been very hard to treat. And as they're watching the interactions between the proteins in malaria and the placenta, it occurs to somebody, you know, this looks a lot like, in many ways, this placenta behaves an awful lot like a tumor. And one thing leads to another. This treatment for malaria change a few ingredients along the way, and suddenly you've got a protein that attaches itself to cancer. You put a little bit of toxin in it. It attaches itself to the cancer, does not attach itself to the other healthy tissues in the person's body, and it just eliminates the cancer. And it's wonderful because apparently this malaria protein is very sticky. And it seeks the tumor out, and it gets a hold of it, and it doesn't let go. The initial research that they've done using rats has been extremely encouraging. They're wiping out prostate cancer. They're wiping out all, various forms of cancer, both in vitro and in laboratory animals. And they're getting ready to, I believe, do some human trials on this. And I say the sooner the better.
Yeah, and this is one of those things that I would definitely think, you know, you soften the rules for human testing for those who, you know, are dealing with end-stage cancer. You know, let them have, you know, have the opportunity to try this. You know, if that were a challenge I was facing, I would definitely want the chance to try it, you know, perhaps for my own survival, but just to say, so, you know what, they learned something from what I'm going through, even if it doesn't help me survive. And so, This is remarkable. It's showing like it's working on like 90% of the types of cancer that that they tested it on, and
exactly.
That was just remarkable. Including, really deadly stuff. Hodgkin's lymphoma that just goes everywhere in a person's body, and is just very deadly as a result of it. It metastasizes everywhere at the same time, basically.
It's a little misleading to say that they've accidentally done it, because obviously they looked at this and, you know, realized that there might be an application. But the genius of this
and they've been looking at the placenta for a while too as an analogy in a way to a tumor.
Yep.
And if you think about it, it grows very fast, right? It's basically a foreign body in the sense that it's not part of the woman's body. It's part of, you know, it's harboring something that's not part of the woman's
right.
body, and
right.
and it's growing on its own, and it's had in some ways it has its own agenda, doesn't it? That's maybe
Absolutely.
Separate from the rest of the body.
Truly in a parasitical way, kind of at the expense of the other tissues around it. I mean, in some ways it's a lot like cancer in those kinds of respects.
Yeah, and so and this is coming from guys that have had four kids. So we love children. Let's put that.
Yeah,
out.
I don't mean to say not to say they're the same thing, but
we're not saying anything anti kids. We love kids, but they've looked at that and said, you know what? Maybe we can learn from this. And because malaria unfortunately attacks children in utero. Then they said, well, maybe we can get it to attack cancer in the same way. And, turns out it might work, and, guys, go for it. The faster, the better. Let's learn.
The real genius of this is you look at, malaria and you see how aggressive it is and how relentless it is. And you take those characteristics of malaria, which are embedded, encoded into this protein, and you turn them on something else, right? I mean, it's the beauty of the, you know, the law of unintended consequences. Except these are intended consequences. This is what happens when you start gaining some leverage in nature, right? For thousands of years, we've just been victims of all these things, malaria and cancer, and it's like, okay, well, here's a thought. You know, what if malaria and cancer get in a fight? If we get beaten up on
Godzilla
each other,
movie.
Exactly.
You remember the Godzilla movie? What should we do? Let them fight.
Yes, let them fight. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let malaria do all the harm it can to cancer,
and
we come out way ahead. Yeah.
That's cool. Very cool story, and. Again, another example of a far future item that's happening right now. So we are living in the future.
It's happening now. And I'll say one other thing about this is, listen, we get the cure for cancer a couple times a year, sometimes 5-6 times a year. And you know what? We will report every single one of them because these are adding up to something. You know, one of my predictions for the future is that we're going to very soon see a day where cancer is at least as livable a condition generally as diabetes. Right, it's something
I disagree because I don't think it's sufficiently optimistic, Phil. You've said that many times, and I always go, you know, I don't know if I buy that. I think that cancer will be something that you get and then you kill it and it's gone. And if you get cancer again, it's a totally separate disease.
I don't think it's a chronic condition. That's why I say at least. One thing that happens often with cancer is that it recurs. And no one hopes more than I do that we really will have things that will once and for all clear all cancer out of a body. Having observed it sort of up close with my dad, where you think it's gone and then it's back, even if dealing with that can be more like taking insulin for diabetes, we'll be so much better off. However, I will say that I hope you're right. And I hope that my at least is not just a weasel word and not just a hedge, but that it actually ends up that way, that you go in one time and you just clean it all out, you know, let the malaria or whatever it is do its work and you got no more cancer in your body. No, nobody would be more excited about that than I will. And
Absolutely.
You know,
I think it's important. You know, that, like you said, they, we report, you know, a half a dozen cures for cancer a year. Here's the thing. I think ultimately the solution is not going to be one thing. I think we're going to have a toolbox of solutions. And you know, each cancer, you know, may have its, you know, you pull out different tools to deal with, you know, this particular thing in your particular body, you know. So you tailor the solution not just to the disease, but also to the person in which the disease is found. And so you just need a big toolbox. And so, hey, if we're developing the tools right now, great. Let's get on it and get it done quickly.
Yep, and the more the merrier. Keep bringing them. Malaria, white blood, whatever. Anything you got that takes out tumors, I think, you know.
Transfusion from young people in sunny places.
Yep.
You know, you know, we've even discussed that. Just all of these things. Yeah, let's have it. So.
Anything that's going to help, absolutely. Okay, so our next one is I actually misstated this in the kind of misrepresented this one in the show description. Talk about printers that can create whole buildings in 24 hours. Well, you know what? Even I can't claim that there's anything futuristic about that. Those devices exist, and we've talked about those devices existing. So what's really interesting about the one that we're highlighting here on the show tonight is that this is a 3D printer that does all those wonderful things. You can build a house in 24 hours, and you can also fit it on the back of a truck. And you don't need a whole host of special equipment put in place first before you can 3D print your house. I don't know, Steven, if you had a chance to follow the link and watch the video of this thing, the animation of this thing in action. But this is a really game-changing 3D, industrial 3D printer, a construction-level
3D printer. I ultimately had to go to the website for this company and watch it there because it was just not – it was herky-jerky at your link, Phil. So let me – if anyone's having a problem watching it at the link, go actually to the company's website. It's Apis Core, A-P-I-S dash
C-O-R.com.
Watch it there if you're having trouble watching it at the link. It's amazing. It has a reach of about 600 square feet or 600
about 600
you know,
square
feet all, and also it can go up to almost unlimited height and just sits there and prints your house out of, I guess, a concrete substance, Phil, and so you can have straight walls if you like, but you can have curved walls too. It opens up types of construction that might not be possible with other materials, and you know, instead of having an army of workers out there at your job sites, you could have a couple of people probably just one person monitoring the computer that's running the printer, and maybe one other person that's, you know, making sure that it's continuing to get the substance that it's printing with, and monitoring the machine itself to make sure that it's not malfunctioning in any way. But I mean, just a couple of people could sit there and in 24 hours build your house.
It's very cool. You know, two things that struck me about this. One is that whether it's from this device or from other 3D printers that are being put in place to do construction, the suburbs are about to get a whole lot more interesting, okay? The next few generations of suburbs, subdivisions that get built can be a lot freer in terms of design than anything we've seen up to this point. The whole idea, if you live in a subdivision,
the suburban ranch house is going to go away.
Well, you know, the whole idea of the prefab, you know, I live in a huge suburb in Denver called Highlands Ranch, and there are several builders, and each builder has three or four or maybe five or six floor plans. But basically you go from neighborhood to neighborhood, and you see the same house over and over, right? And the reason you see that is because that model scales, right? You know, they've prefabbed all the parts. and it's easy to build those houses. And so they would go into a neighborhood and they would build so many of this one and so many of that one and so many of the third one. And basically, you know, you've got the same houses over and over with essentially the same color schemes because the HOA put that in place. And, you know, I mean, it's a nice enough neighborhood, but that whole kind of nightmarish side of the suburbs comes through as you drive through it, and you go, it's just kind of the same stuff over and over. Well, here, with this kind of technology, you can now build a house more quickly, not just as quickly, more quickly, and the idea of having to preassemble standardized parts no longer comes into play. A 3D printer means that, you know, you can just as easily make it, you were saying, Steve, it could be curved, it could be a circle, or it could be any number of really interesting fleur-de-lis shapes or something like that. Now, HOAs are going to come in and say you can't have too interesting of a looking house, and there's going to be a real interesting, I think, battle between people's aesthetics and, you know, the desire to have resale value and the desire to define a certain level of uniformity. But we're going to see some really interesting neighborhoods coming up in years to come.
Yeah.
And the idea that a house needs to be rectangular, I think, is going to go away. I think we will, you know, we'll still see rectangular houses because people like it and it's functional and everything. But we'll see lots of other variations, too. And it will be just as common for houses to have other shapes as it is for them to be rectangles.
Yeah. And since, they creativity is possible, I think that it'll almost be expected. I mean, you know, you'll want to have your house to be a little bit different from every other house in the world. I mean, there'll be some similarities, but you know what? I'm going to add this little thing over here and this, and of course, you going back to the gentleman you talked to earlier today, Phil. I mean, you can walk through your house before it's actually built. And make sure that it looks and has has your stamp of approval on it and is what you want prior to actually it being printed. So it's going to be fascinating to see. And this is, and you know what I'm also excited about is it's going to allow people that couldn't afford houses otherwise to own a home, and that's huge.
That's right.
When people own homes, that one thing tends to pull people out of permanent poverty better. It's a predictor for people being out of permanent poverty more than practically any other thing. That is an amazing thing. Just, you know, and so you can print big houses, you can print little houses. It will allow people to have their first home. It might be small or whatever, but it'll be theirs. And so I'm excited about that part of it too.
Well, and you look at the kind of mass production that allowed for the suburbs was a big step in that direction of making housing, more of a consumer product and a much more affordable kind of thing. But this is a quantum leap past that. I mean, this is a huge step in that same direction.
What was the name of those? What were the name of those homes they made a million of after World War II? I'm thinking of the guy's name. They had all those suburbs, and it was practically the same house stamped out again and again and again. And he did it cheaply, and it sort of and the idea took off everywhere in the United States. There was after World War II and led to the baby boom and all that. But anyway, this is the next step after this. This is
the other big implication for this, as far as I'm concerned, is colonizing Mars, right? Or any place you want to colonize.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about, you go in and build the structures first. It's like, okay, well, here's the machine, right? All you need now is something that turns Mars sand into cement, into some kind of concrete. And now you've got the machine where you can go build your whole city on Mars before you send any of the astronauts there. You've now really got a reasonably portable means of doing massive construction. I mean, if you use a little bit of imagination with this thing, it's like the implications are pretty profound in terms of what something like this could get done in a relatively short period of time. I think it's got big implications here on Earth and potentially big implications for us out in space as well.
The name I was looking for is William Levitt. And he had the Levitt towns. You know that.
That's right. Okay, I've heard of those. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that, if you could and do it on do that on the moon, print structures on the moon, you could have these things. You know, you could have these things set down, robots set down on the moon and on Mars, and just and build out of the materials that are already there. That's the only, to me, it's the only practical way of settling those places, is to have the infrastructure in place, perhaps even before the first astronaut sets foot on Mars. So, that's exciting stuff there.
That might be the way to do it. And speaking of sending astronauts out into space, this is the conceptual one coming up here, by the way. Oh, I think we skipped one. I'm moving on to why we need to colonize the universe. But did we skip the one about human consciousness? I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with my web connection, so I can't see the page and I can't see the link.
The one I had next is the moral obligation to colonize space. I might skip to two, Bill.
That's where I was going anyhow. So,
okay,
that works.
All right,
that works fine for me. I don't know if you had a chance to watch this video. This is some pretty interesting stuff. Christopher E. Mason is the associate professor of computational genomics at Weill Cornell Medical College, and he lays out a very far-reaching vision for the future. And he suggests that. We've all heard this idea that, well, we can't put all our eggs in one basket, that not only humanity, but all of the terrestrial biosphere needs to be moved out to other locations in space. So anything happens to this planet, humanity goes on, and all the life that has evolved here will go on as well. And he takes that idea to its logical extreme. He says, well, that's true. We can move out into space, and then if anything happens to Earth, we'll still, humanity will still survive. But ultimately, in a few billion years, actually in several billion years, the universe is going to collapse, and we would all die anyway. So we need to go out and fill the whole universe, and we need to basically master the laws of physics so that we can keep some or all of the universe from collapsing. Basically, we need to go out and these are not his words, but this is what it means to me when I watch the video and read the transcript. We've got to go out and subdue the universe, okay? And we need to do that to keep us going. That if our survival is a goal worth pursuing, and I think he just sort of starts with the assumption that it is, and I think it's a pretty good assumption, then that involves, sure, in the shorter term, that we need to get out into space, so in case anything happens to Earth. But in the long term, we've got to get out into the cosmos because, everything's got a shelf life on it here in the universe, and we have to become tremendously powerful cosmic beings in order to keep humanity going. I don't know. Am I exaggerating the argument, Stephen, or is that what you've heard as well?
Yeah, I think it's not exaggerating. If you think about it, it's sort of the Judeo-Christian ethic of, the earth is yours, subdue it, taken to its logical conclusion, isn't it? I happen to agree with it. I think, if you take on that level of responsibility that level of power has a huge level of responsibility, is what I'm trying to say. And
right.
If you're going to be a civilization that can do a Dyson swarm, for example, you do so in such a way that you're not destroying maybe the planet that that harbors life in that solar system. So you think about things like that, and we. There are trade-offs with technology that we're experiencing at our level of technology, of course. I mean, we pollute the environment, and but it seems like as we push forward technologically, we solve a lot of the problems of yesterday's technology with our new technology, but get a few new problems too. And so it seems to me it's
right.
always that way. We take two steps forward, one step back, and then two steps forward again. But you still manage to get make progress with that two steps forward, one step back. So I guess that's a long answer to your question, Phil. Is that the argument? Yes, it is. And
I think it is. I think it's absolutely
agree.
The argument. Here's what I think is missing from the argument. Okay, where this argument falls down for me is only in this one place, which is what do we do about anyone else who is also out there, also working on the same priority? Because it's one thing to subdue a universe wherein you're the only, sentient beings, right? It's like, okay, well, if that's the case, right, it's ours for the taking, as far as I'm concerned, because there's no one to argue, right? But what if there is somebody to argue? What if there are a lot of somebodies to argue? Well, in that case, then we have to find a way, I think, to, if possible, exist cooperatively with them. We don't need to subdue them necessarily. And in fact, I feel bad even having used that word necessarily. It would be wrong to think that they're there for us to push out of the way so that we can move on ahead. On the other hand, it would be wrong for them to feel that way about us. It's in our common interest, us and whoever they are, to do exactly what is being discussed here, which is to, which is to find a way to keep going. So ultimately, we find others out in the universe. We've got to join up with them and become, one, if not entity, one common cause between two or multiple or many myriad intelligences and civilizations who all have this, this common goal, which is we're not going to let the end of the universe be the end of us. Now, that vastly complicates the picture if they are out there, and it makes the whole project in many ways much more difficult. And it could be that it's a lot easier if you're kind of a post-singularity superintelligence and you meet up with another post-singularity superintelligence. It could be that it's a lot easier for them to sync up than it would be for us if we met up with beings of about our current level, right? Because we're we're still kind of focused on a lot of very earthbound, very backwards looking kinds of issues. So it's possible to hope that by the time we meet up with anyone, we'll be far enough along that we'll be ready to join up with someone like that. But I think that's the big caution here. What if there's somebody else?
It reminds me of the vision, Phil, of Arthur C. Clarke. You may recall in some of the 2001 and 2010 and that series of books that intelligence was basically said, they had this idea that there's just basically one precious thing in the entire universe, and that's intelligence, sentience. And so they, wherever they went, they would seek to join with the sentience that they found and seek to foster it. And that's what they, in the fictional universe of 2001, that's what they did on Earth. They encouraged these ape-like beings to become humans so that eventually they could come and join them as well. So I think that's a neat vision of it. And I tend to agree that post-singularity civilizations will have more in common than they have different. Whereas pre-singularity civilizations, would have such differences that they couldn't really they'd have much to offer one another. But that's interesting, and I think that yes, as we would if we move out into the universe and we discover others like us, hopefully we'll all be post-singularity and it'll work out, No sociopathic civilizations out there, hopefully.
There's a very famous thing that Tolstoy wrote in Anna Karenina. He said that happy families are all alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And I think, there might be an analogy here where, right now humanity is not entirely a happy family, and we're unhappy in our own way, and any other species at our level of development would probably be unhappy in its own way. But here's hoping
that post-singularity, we will truly be a happy family, and we'll meet up with other happy families out there. Now, there's a sunny vision of the universe, huh? By golly.
No,
all these happy families meeting and saving the universe together.
That sounds pretty great.
That's about as good as it gets right there.
That's a great plan. I'm glad to be a part of it.
exactly right. Oh, okay. So we got two more. We got about 5 minutes, so we're gonna dash through. Especially because I can't even open the link, the consciousness switch. But what I wanted to say about this one, and I think this is very interesting. You know, it's possible that that scientists have figured out the way to turn consciousness on and off in a brain. Now, I didn't get far enough in reading up on this to say, well, what does that mean? When you flip that switch, the person just becomes unconscious, in which case I'm not sure how different it is from sleeping, right? Or, is this the thing that effectively gets thrown when you bump your head or something like that? But assuming they have actually located a switch for consciousness, this puts us one step closer, I think, to solving that hard problem of consciousness. If we've even just identified how you turn it on and off, it seems that we're closer now to the physiology of consciousness than we have been before. I'm not saying that we know anything or that the problem is by any means solved, but this is a really important step in that direction.
Maybe from this we can learn the direction in which to look for the answer to the hard problem.
There's an anchor now. Right. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, well, we've got one physiological thing around consciousness that we really do understand. So let's build from there.
Well, imagine a super genius like Leonardo da Vinci being transported to our time. And, you know, as we walk into a room to, you know, kind of show him around our home, I flip a switch and the light comes on. He's amazed, of course. And, he looks at that switch, and eventually he cracks the plate open and looks, hey, what's this back here? Wires, you know. Where does this go? What does it do? You know, so maybe it'll be analogous to that. Maybe we begin looking in the right direction, hopefully, because we found the switch. That's a neat idea.
Absolutely. All right. Well, so one final one, and before we bring this one out, I want to review a conversation that we've had in the past. You know, Stephen, you and I, we don't make too many predictions. We make the occasional prediction. But I believe you have been on the record predicting when life extension treatments would begin. And can you remind our audience in what year you said that would happen?
Well, let's see. In 2005, I think it was, Phil. It might have been a year after that. It might have been 2006 or so. I said it would be within 14 years. Which would it be about 2019, 2020. And here we are, 2015.
Here we are, 2015, so within 14 years. And the story is biotech CEO undergoes gene hacking to reverse aging. So here is an actual treatment that is being deployed, that is being tried out by, you know, I'm going to say a very brave executive from a biotech company who's looking to see if perhaps tweaking her genes can't actually turn aging around. Now, this is, you know, it's on the cusp, isn't it? It's somewhere between just pure research and a treatment. But if it turns out to be a treatment, you know, Stephen, I think we'll be able to look back and say, yeah, maybe you weren't optimistic enough reverse aging treatments began in 2015.
I remember part of the prediction I made was that, it may very well be that the treatment that reverses aging, at least version 1.0 of age reversal, might be marketed as a treatment for something else like obesity or heart disease or cancer or something like that, but it would ultimately be seen eventually as the beginning of anti-age. That's not, you know, so I may end up being wrong if this turns out to be the case, if this turns out to work, because I mean, she's just out and out saying, hey, I'm not getting this treatment for, you know, the fact that I'm fat or got cancer or something. This is for
yeah. Any other health
aid.
Benefits aside, I'm doing this.
Yeah, I'm patient zero in the battle against aging, and that's pretty cool. And you know, I'd like to be wrong about that prediction, because if the treatment is introduced to the world as something that is clearly anti-aging, this is the reason for it. I think
right.
that it would tend to be, you know, doctors would be less coy about it. You know, I mean, if I go in there and, you know, I'm 80 years old and I'm wanting to do something about the fact that I'm becoming quite decrepit and can't get around and do, you know, and, I go in there and, doctor, can you help me with this? Well, no, I can't help you with that. But you are overweight, Stephen, and you got this problem and that problem, and maybe we can do something about that. You know, no, just hey, give me the anti-aging. You know,
right?
And let's not play games, doctor. Let's attack it for what it is, which is which is a problem. You know.
I think philosophically, conceptually, it's a lot easier to sell the world on the idea of, hey, we've talked about this lots of times. Look, we're not trying to cure aging. We just want to cure cancer, diabetes, heart disease, right? If we can just completely eliminate those, that'll be a huge step. It'll be tremendous medical.
Not being old really helps with those things.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, if the thing that ultimately does away with those does away with aging too, okay, well, we'll take that side effect, right? I mean, you know, you twist my arm. But maybe that's just a overly subtle way of getting there. If there is a way to actually do this, and this turns out to be something practical, then, you know, I think you're right. I think we're pretty close to a generation who would just say, look, we're not going to play games. Maybe you and I are that generation, right? When I'm 85, I will have very little patience for wanting to pretend it's something else. It's like, okay, I'd like to just get the whole package, please. Can we just back the whole thing up? All the health benefits we talk about would be there, and it would be a tremendous medical savings. This huge amount of money that's spent on people in the last few years of their lives, we could eliminate that expense. I think when it's available, it's going to be a huge economic boon that people don't even recognize yet.
Imagine all of the experience, and, you know, not just the human cost of losing loved ones and things like that as they get older, but you know, just the loss. You know, when an elderly person dies, a library burns. Okay.
Right.
And
right.
So we won't lose that. We'll have the benefit of these people hanging with us and continuing to, you know, find new ways of, you know, doing new things. And so that's huge economic benefit of being able to do that. I was going to say, you know, originally Viagra, as you may know, Phil, was a circulation drug, and then they found that it caused a circulation increase in a particular part of a man's body, and of course they weren't acute about that. They said exactly what it was, and they marketed it as such. So maybe it'd be something similar with anti-aging. Maybe they stumble upon it while looking for something else, but they don't play around. If they find out that it has that effect, maybe they'll just market it as such, and we'll all be able to just go to the doctor and ask for the anti-aging Viagra pill. So,
well, I'll tell you what, right. While they're looking at it, they might as well see if there's something malaria can do to aging, right? And just let malaria and AIDS find it out. I'm becoming a real believer in malaria as a fighting force. Okay, well, there you have it. Amazing things that might happen in the future, or oops, they're happening now. So that's our show. Stephen, what's our music?
Music tonight is Louder Kinematic.
Kinematic?
Kinematic. With a
kinematic with Louder. All right. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back again next week at the normal night with an all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.